I want to thank the people of this country for turning out to vote in a December election that we didn't want to call, but which I think has turned out to be a historic election that gives us now, in this new government, the chance to respect the democratic will of the British people, to change this country for the better, and to unleash the potential of the entire people of this country. And that is what we will now do tomorrow. Thank you all very much. Or rather, I should say, not tomorrow, today. Today. Thank you all.
That, of course, was Boris Johnson celebrating the victory that he just was handed by the voters of Great Britain. I'm Warren Alney. This is To The Point. With us on the phone, we have Mary Dashefsky, who is the former Washington bureau chief for the independent newspaper in London. She's former diplomatic editor as well, and now chief editorial writer. We are old friends. We've had coffee together in London, and it's great to have you back on our program.
Thank you.
So was this, in fact, historic? In what sense? That's the term that Mr. Boris Johnson himself used.
Well, it was historic in quite a number of ways. I mean, it was a huge gamble for Boris Johnson to engineer calling an election for December. This was the first December election since 1920-something or other. And there were all sorts of worries that maybe the weather would be too bad, that people would be fed up being called out to vote in December, nobody would turn up, or they would be so cross that they would vote against everybody.
Not another one? Oh, for God's sake, I can't stand this. There's too much politics going on at the moment.
I guess if you don't vote, then you can't complain about why it's not working. So I think there were some real choices to be made this time, and some real issues.
I am frankly terrified.
I don't think any of the options are great, to be honest.
Yeah.
Likewise, just a bit of shambles, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not being done very well.
Turned up today and I really wasn't sure. I put the cross where I put it at the very end, but I didn't know until I did it.
I was still undecided walking up the steps into the polling station this morning. It's been a very difficult choice. It really has been choosing the least worst option, which has been difficult.
None of those things happened. But the other way in which it's historic is that this is the first Conservative Party leader who has got a majority of this size in the House of Commons since Margaret Thatcher. It's a majority that rivals the majorities that Tony Blair had for the Labour Party. And it's the first time that the UK has a majority government now since the election was called in 2010 that resulted in a coalition. So we've had 10 years of pretty much political turmoil. Suddenly, we've got this extraordinary clarity in the House of Commons.
What is the clarity about? What is clear that wasn't before?
Well, there's been complete wrangling with no party and no opinion in the House of Commons being able to get a majority. Ever since the Europe referendum in 2016, even though we had another election in 2017, still the House of Commons was so fragmented over the whole issue of leaving Europe that nobody, not Theresa May and not in the few months that he had as Prime Minister Boris Johnson, were they able to get a majority for approving the Brexit deal that they'd agreed with Brussels. Now there is complete clarity because not only does Boris Johnson have this huge majority, but his party, his parliamentary party, is united in a way it wasn't before, because he made it a condition of the people who were going to be candidates for MPs at this election, formally undertaking that they would support Brexit. He was absolutely ruthless before Parliament was resolved.
About the consequences of this vote tonight, it means that Parliament is on the brink of wrecking any deal that we might be able to strike in Brussels, because tomorrow's bill would hand control of the negotiations to the EU, and that would mean more dither, more delay, and more confusion. And it would mean that the EU themselves would be able to decide how long to keep this country in the EU. And since I refuse to go along with that plan, we are going to have to make a choice.
He withdrew the whip from, which basically suspended from party membership, several really eminent and long-standing Conservatives in the House of Commons who were regarded as rather unsympathetic towards Brexit. That was an absolutely ruthless thing to do, but the result is that he's got a united party in the House of Commons.
Is the party conservative in the sense that we regard that term here in the United States?
That is a very good question. I would say probably not. There are certainly different strands of opinion on economic matters as to how free market the Conservative Party is. There is also a question about how conservative with a small c it is on social issues. I would say that Boris Johnson's party, at least the MPs who are now elected to the House of Commons, are more socially liberal than conservatives would be in the United States, and they're also less free market. But there's a division of opinion on that. Some of them are much more free market than others, and some of that division may come out as a trade deal, as negotiations for a trade deal go on, both with Brussels and Boris Johnson hopes with the United States.
So there's new clarity, and yet this is democracy, so not everything is clear, that's for sure, and probably won't be for some time. Tell us a bit about Boris Johnson himself. You worked with him at one point.
I did. When he was a trainee journalist at the Times, when I was on the Times writing editorials and op-eds. And he makes a very contradictory impression because he's supremely confident. He is very charming. Like a lot of really good politicians, he never forgets people. He's got a brilliant memory for where he's seen people, who they are, and where they sort of fit into his past or present. As a journalist, he obviously became very successful when he moved to the Telegraph. He was actually dismissed from the Times for fabricating a quotation, which he then attributed to one of his well-placed relatives. You know, it's probably not the first time or the last time that a journalist has done that, but, you know, as a trainee, he was in quite a vulnerable position. But his contacts and his general charm and the fact that, you know, he writes very well. He got a job almost immediately on the Daily Telegraph, and that's where he has been writing a weekly column with a vast paycheck for the last several years. And he was, for several years too, he was the Daily Telegraph's correspondent in Brussels. And the Telegraph, like Boris Johnson, after he'd considered his views on Brexit, the Telegraph was very Eurosceptic paper, so the two fitted quite well together.
But he is not an ink-stained wretch as a journalist. He is somebody who comes from a prominent family. He went to Eton and I believe Oxford as well. Is that not the case?
Yes, and he was president of the Oxford Union, which, of course, is, you know, regarded as a bit of a training ground or a nursery for future politicians, including prime ministers. I would say something else about him, too. I mean, what is often forgotten is that he spent some of his childhood and youth in Brussels because his father, Stanley Johnson, was a Eurocrat way back. So, you know, but Boris Johnson knows how Brussels works. He knows how the European Union works. He also speaks French, which he sometimes conceals, but he speaks pretty good French.
Les zones libérées, on ira.
Trying to stabilize and liberate.
Le Rakaoui.
I didn't understand that.
Le Rakaoui, le gens à Raqqa.
Ah, le Raqqa, right.
Il s'appelle le Rakaoui.
It might just be best to stick to the headlines in French and then perhaps...
You think so?
Well, it may get lost in...
They love it when I talk
French. Yeah. And I think all those things were actually assets for him. You know, in the few weeks he spent as Prime Minister after he was elected leader of the Conservative Party, and before he called the election, it was possible to see how he went travelling around and meeting European leaders who'd been very negatively disposed towards him. Nonetheless, he managed to get changes into the agreement that Theresa May had concluded with Brussels, and he managed to establish what seem now to be actually quite good working relations with Chancellor Merkel, with Emmanuel Macron, and with several of the leaders who before seemed to be quite quite hostile towards him.
Okay, so you say that there is new clarity, but you have also written that things aren't as simple as they sound. I want to come back to you and talk more about that and more about your statement that Britain already feels smaller than it used to feel. But first, let me turn to Yascha Mounk. He is a contributing writer at The Atlantic, an associate professor at Johns Hopkins, and a senior fellow at the German Marshall Fund. And he's author of a book called The People Versus Democracy, Why Our Freedom is in Danger and How to Save It. He's also an old friend of this program. And Yascha Mounk, good to have you back.
My pleasure to be back.
We've heard that the Conservative Party now more unified than it has been in the past, but different from what we think of as a Conservative Party in this country. How should we apply the lessons of this election in Britain?
Well, I think it's told us something very interesting and very important about two of the leading political currents in our time, in Britain, in the United States, and really across Western politics. The first is a lesson about what makes populism so appealing at the moment, and the second is a lesson about how the left might be able to respond to this populism or not to respond to this populism. So let's start with Boris Johnson. In my mind, his party, whose official name is the Conservative and Unionist Party, is really nothing of the sort anymore. It has turned into a kind of populist party. And what I mean by populism in this context specifically is the claim that they and they alone truly speak for the people, that they are the only legitimate interpreters of the popular will. That is precisely what Johnson claims when he says that his is the party of the people, implying that all the other parties are somehow not of the people. And it is what allowed him to suspend Parliament at a crucial juncture a few months ago, because he feared that the representatives of the people who were actually elected might overturn what he wanted to do on Brexit. But the important difference between Boris Johnson and Donald Trump, for example, is that Johnson is a relatively moderate populist. That is to say that though he celebrates this kind of cultural revolution of the people rising up against the establishment, for which Brexit and his broadsides against the EU are the most visible manifestation, he is actually choosing a quite center-left course on the economy, promising to increase social spending, spending on healthcare, spending on teachers, spending on policemen in the streets. And even on cultural issues, for he has certainly said his share of controversial things, he is not nearly as far right as somebody like Donald Trump. And most people of color, as they're called, people who are BAME in the United Kingdom, are not scared of Boris Johnson, the way that many Americans are actually quite scared of Donald Trump. And that is what has allowed Boris Johnson to build this extraordinary coalition at this election and gain the biggest Tory majority in many decades.
So how can the left in this country respond to that?
So Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the Labour Party, has been celebrated by big parts of the left in this country as the role model for how Democrats can beat Republicans, for how the left can revitalize itself. Many congressmen who are further on the left in the Democratic Party, many of the leading pundits of the left have said for years, look at Jeremy Corbyn, this should be our inspiration for where we should go.
This manifesto is, and I'm proud of it, the most radical and ambitious plan to transform our country for decades. In an election offering a once-in-a-generation chance for real change, we can end privatisation and rescue our National Health Service. we can get Brexit sorted and bring our country together. We can tackle the climate emergency that threatens us all. And we can rewrite the rules of our economy to work for the many, not the few. Ignore the wealthy and the powerful who tell you that's not possible.
But it has turned out that Jeremy Corbyn has achieved the worst election result for the Labour Party since the 1930s, that voters had an allergic reaction to him, but they found him to be, in many cases, intolerable. When asked why they did not vote for the Labour Party or what worries they had about the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn and many of his policies were at the top of voters' lists. And so it really calls into doubt this theory that what the left needs to do is simply to move very far to the left, that it will somehow enable it to mobilize its base of supporters or to win over the working class, which is increasingly going to the right. And the reason for that, I think, is that the main division in politics today is no longer economic, as it used to be 30 or 40 years ago. It's no longer about how high the taxes should be or how big the welfare state should be. It is about culture. And on culture, the traditional coalition of the left between working class people in more remote industrial towns and upper middle class, highly educated people in big urban centers have very, very different views from each other.
Do you see the same pattern here in this country?
Absolutely. So I think there is an attempt by many people to say in order to beat Donald Trump, Democrats don't have to worry about reaching swing voters or moderates. They only need to mobilize their own base. And the idea they have of that base is as being socialist on economics and what today might be called woke on culture. But it seems to me that that is untrue. It is untrue of many white working class voters who the party needs in order to gain back those crucial states in the Midwest. But it is also true, by the way, of many of the people of color who are in some ways part of the Democratic base. When you think about a 50-year-old African-American USPS worker in Ohio, she speaks a very different language and has very different concerns from those that some of those lefty pundits with postgrad degrees from Ivy League universities claim on Twitter would motivate a voter like that to come out to the polls. And so in my mind, the election in Britain is obviously very important for itself. I'm personally very saddened about Britain leaving the European Union. But it is also a very big warning to Democrats not to follow in the footsteps of Jeremy Corbyn. Or else, I think, despite all of the differences between Johnson and Trump, it would become much more likely that Trump is able to win re-election in 2020.
Yasha Monk, author of People Versus Democracy, Why Our Freedom is in Danger and How to Save It. We'll take a brief break now, and then we'll come back to hear from the defeated British Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn on To the Point.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Well, Rinaldi, as To the Point continues. Mary Joszewski, back to you. Mr. Corbyn had an odd way of conceding or sort of half conceding the election and indicating that he was going to resign and then not actually resigning.
The responsible thing to do is not to walk away from the whole thing, and I won't do that. I will stay here until there has been somebody elected to succeed me, and then I will step down at that point.
What about the fate of the Labour Party in Britain?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, I agree with an awful lot of what Yasha has just been speaking about the cultural differences, and essentially there is a split between, as it were, the Corbyn Labourites and the remains of the Blair Labourites. and whoever becomes the next leader of the Labour Party will either have to take one of those two sides, or they'll have to try and bridge the divide. And in a way, I don't think it was completely out of court for Jeremy Corbyn to say he was resigning, but his resignation wouldn't actually take effect until there was a new leader, because if he'd resigned with effect from election night, the Labour Party would have been without any sort of focal point in the House of Commons or in the country, because his deputy resigned at the very beginning of the election campaign. So we had an almost American-style duel at our election, which is very unusual for Britain, in that we had quite a loner in Boris Johnson for the Conservatives and quite a loner in Jeremy Corbyn for the Labour Party. And there was a very clear left-right division in a way that was almost, it was both ideological and almost presidential as between two characters. There is one point I'm not entirely in agreement with Yasha over, which I think, yes, people who voted, who moved their votes from, who would in the past have always voted Labour, who voted Conservative probably for the first time on Thursday, a lot of them said, yes, you know, they didn't like Jeremy Corbyn, or they regarded his promises of huge public spending and changes in the way the country was run. They regarded that as unrealistic. But I don't completely believe them, because when you look at the map of the people of the constituencies that voted for Conservative, that had voted for Labour in the past, they were all very strong constituencies that had voted for Brexit. When you look at the rest of the country, areas in the south, for instance, and to a lesser extent, sort of successful cities like Manchester and Liverpool, they remained with Labour. London, Labour MPs in London not only kept their majorities, but their majorities were larger. They actually won a seat in London. So the places that voted Remain stuck with Labour, whereas the places that voted Brexit saw the Conservative Party as a Brexit party. And I think there's a real sense in which the latest election was, you know, the second referendum that a lot of people had been calling for. People were voting along Leave or Remain lines, very much as they'd voted in the referendum. So, yes, it was partly to do with Corbyn. It was partly to do with his very leftist agenda. But I think it was much, much more to do with Brexit.
Well, OK, but here's what one dedicated Labour voter has to say about that.
I cannot believe these Labour voters that have voted the Tories in Consett, County Durham. I cannot believe it, like. It's done my head in. That's what this country's come to. If he didn't like Jeremy Corbyn, why didn't we just have a Labour government? If he was no good, we could have got rid of him, like the Tories have done for the last 4 years.
Yasha Monk, you want to chime in?
Yes, I would like to. I think we partially agree on that, but the question is what Brexit really is about in the British context. And Brexit, more than anything else, is the avatar of cultural disagreements about what you want the country to look like, about how much immigration you want, about other kinds of social values. So one of the best predictors in 2016 of who would vote for or against Brexit is people's attitudes, for example, to the death penalty, which on its face has nothing to do with whether or not the United Kingdom is a member of the European Union. So I think the way to understand that big divide about Brexit that is ripping apart the Labour Party is precisely as a big fight over values. Now, the two key constituencies of centre-left parties, not just in Britain, but across the West, have been working-class voters in towns like those northern constituencies that have now flipped to the Conservatives, as well as, nice leafy parts of London in which Labour is continuing to do very well. Constituencies like that represented by Jeremy Corbyn in Islington, where you have a lot of students and teachers and artists and other highly educated middle-class people. And I think what we've seen in this past election is Labour losing all of those working class votes. Labour was founded as a working class party. It is now doing very, very poorly among working class people across the country. And so part of the damage done by this move to the far left is not on the economy. It is precisely on those cultural issues, on Jeremy Corbyn having solidarity with every terrorist organization that has been in the news over the last years, from the IRA to various ones in the Middle East. It is very credible accusations of anti-Semitism against Jeremy Corbyn. It is all of those things that make a lot of ordinary Brits look at him and think, I'm not sure he really cares about my well-being. He's a little bit strange. He seems to care much more about those strange ideological causes than about bread and butter issues that actually affect me. And that's why those two things, in my mind, go together. The cultural dimension and the mistrust of Jeremy Corbyn are precisely what has driven so many working class voters away from the Labour Party into the hands of Boris Johnson's Conservatives.
Mary Duszewski, as I indicated earlier, you have said that the country already feels smaller. And you talk about that in terms of the fact that Britain is no longer a part of the EU, where it was a very effective member, and now it's more or less on its own. It might also be smaller if, in fact, Scotland devotes to dissociate itself from the UK or Northern Ireland. Are those things actually possible?
I think they're eminently possible. When you looked at the maps after the election are really quite striking, because England has become much more blue. Scotland has become much more yellow for the Scottish nationalists. And Northern Ireland, for the first time in a general election, it was parties that were less sympathetic to the Union than the Union, who got a majority of the MPs in Northern Ireland. Now, personally, I think that that we may see a united Ireland, and to that extent the loss of Northern Ireland to the United Kingdom, we may see that much sooner than we see in independent Scotland, because the mechanics of it are easier. There's actually provision in the Good Friday Agreement. There is provision for, if sentiment changes in the north, for a referendum to be held on the question of uniting with the Republic of Ireland. So, as it were, the mechanisms are there, and that is possible.
Would that be a disaster for England, comparable to losing Scotland?
It depends who you talk to and what your sentiment is. My view is that a united Ireland is probably, sooner or later, is probably inevitable. That in the sort of long process of history, that is the trend. There were quite a lot of people during the Troubles in Northern Ireland who said, oh, for heaven's sake, you know, can't we just sort of tow Northern Ireland off into the North Atlantic? And so I don't think there would be such sorrow at the loss to the United Kingdom of Northern Ireland as there would be soul-searching about Scotland, except among the people who are very firmly of the belief that the Union is something that needs to be saved at all costs. But the interesting thing was that halfway through this past year, there was a very interesting opinion poll done by the YouGov polling organisation among Conservatives. And what they found was that among Conservatives, and as Yasha pointed out, you know, this party still calls itself the Conservative and Unionist Party, there was a majority among the people who polled who said that Brexit was worth the breakup of the UK. In other words, the potential breakup, the potential loss of Scotland and Northern Ireland was a price worth paying for England to leave the European Union, and that I think that came as quite a shock to a lot of people.
Joshua Munk, what do you think about that? You are of German nationality. You study or have studied in the United Kingdom. You now live in the United States, so you have experience across the board. Will it be worth it to England if, in fact, it loses Scotland and Ireland? And what about its clout as a result of being in the EU? Is it, in a real sense, a smaller country than it used to be?
Well, I mean, look, first of all, I think there is a deep bond between Britain and the European continent, and that bond has deepened over the last decades thanks to the European Union. There are many Britons living within the territory of the European Union, especially pensioners living in Spain, but also lots of young people working in Paris and Berlin and other cities. And there are many generations of Europeans who came to Britain in order to live and study, to work. And for me personally, I am a U.S. citizen, but I'm also a German citizen. You know, this past election means no longer having natural access to the United Kingdom, no longer knowing that if I choose to go and live there for a couple of years, I can just show my German passport at the border and be able to go and live there. And that, I think, is going to change Britain. It is going to slow the migration between those two areas and will help to make those paths diverge a little bit more. As a European who loves the United Kingdom, that's very melancholy for me. Now, you know, I think in terms of a question about the Union and about what a future Britain will look like, I want to say two things. The first is that the future of Scotland and Northern Ireland depends, of course, strongly on how Westminster acts, on how Boris Johnson acts. And it seems likely to me that he will not grant Scotland another independence referendum in the next years, that Britain will behave towards Scotland in the coming years a little bit more like the central government in Spain is behaving towards Catalonia. And so we may actually get a pretty heated conflict about whether or not London has to grant Scotland this next referendum. That will be a very interesting and potentially scary flashpoint to observe. The second question is that Boris Johnson now has a tremendous amount of power to shape the future of Britain. Does he go for a deal with Europe in which there is actually the possibility of a lot of a relatively free movement between the two blocs, in which there is a very close trading relationship, in which Britain is using this moment as an opportunity, as he has claimed, to open itself up to the world? Or do the more provincial and perhaps the more hard right factions of a Conservative Party win out? And what we get is a kind of little England that seals itself off from the world, is very suspicious of outsiders, and so on. And I think that is the big question that will have to start being answered over the next years.
I want to ask you both a question that doesn't relate directly to the electoral situation, but goes beyond that. There appears to be, and Britain is certainly an example of it, a move away from internationalism to nationalism. I think both of you have commented about that. The question becomes, what then with regard to global warming and climate change, since international cooperation appears to be the only way that we can actually get a handle on that? Mary Dushevsky, first to you on that question.
I think that maybe this is an area where Boris Johnson in particular probably differs quite a lot from Donald Trump, because I don't see any particular change in terms of Britain's attitude of cooperating with international organizations or with international projects. And I think that in some ways that sort of relationship, multilateral relationship, could become more important in Brexit Britain than it has been before. But in one respect, I absolutely agree, which is that a lot of people sort of have tended to treat the Brexit vote as an expression of nostalgia for the empire, that Britain would be singing Rule Britannia again and that it was all about ruling the waves all over again. When I was covering the referendum, that's not how the Leave voters by and large came across to me. There was a very strong view that Britain was actually putting itself around the world far too much, that the wars in Iraq, the intervention in Libya, intervention in Afghanistan had been complete disasters for Britain, and that that sort of thing should really not be part of what the country was doing in the future. I don't see that view extended to things like global warming, climate change, or cooperating on, you know, what might be called more sort of peaceful projects. And I think that Boris Johnson might be keen to use those sort of and participation in those sort of organisations to try and show that Britain isn't isolating itself from the world.
And Britain has made serious commitments about climate change and reduction of emissions. And has followed through as well. Yascha Mounk, of course, President Trump has made the United States the only nation to actually pull out of the Paris Accords.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think on this question of nationalism and climate change, you need to see two things at the same time. The first is that climate change is an incredibly existential threat to us, that we need to take a quick and serious action in order to deal with climate change. And at the same time, but both on the substance, when you look at what the experts actually say about what is required in order to fight climate change, and on the politics, on how we can actually build the broad coalition of people we need in order to confront the serious menace, we don't need to change everything. We need to invest in clean energies. We need to have a carbon tax. We need to have sensible regulation that moves us towards a low or no carbon economy in a rapid way. But we don't have to give up on economic growth. We don't have to give up on capitalism. And we certainly don't have to give up on the nation state. And I think the big danger is if we say, hey, to deal with climate change, you're going to have to completely change how you live. And by the way, you also have to stop ruling yourself in the ways that you're accustomed to, give more and more power away from national parliaments. That's the only way to deal with climate change. And a lot of people are going to say, you know what, then let's not deal with climate change. If that's what you're telling me, then perhaps you're not really worried about climate change. You just want to push through the agenda that you've always cared about for other reasons. And so I think in that small respect, I hope that Boris Johnson's Britain will be a good example, that you can live up to international commitments on climate change, that you can refuse to pull out of the Paris Accords in the way that Donald Trump has shamefully done, while still giving people a sense that they're governed at the level of a nation state and that they have some real sovereignty in their country.
Well, thank you both very much for being on our program. We're going to talk a bit about what happened in Madrid at the latest conference on climate change. Yascha Mounk, again, at The Atlantic, his book, The People Versus Democracy, Why Our Freedom is in Danger and How to Save It. And Mary Dushevsky, the chief editorial writer for the Independent newspaper in London. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Foreman on back with To the Point. We have just been joined by Somini Sengupta, who covers international climate issues for the New York Times, and she has just been at the Madrid conference on climate change. She's also, I should add, the author of The End of Karma, Hope and Fury Among India's Young. India, a very important country in terms of climate change. Somini Sengupta, great to have you back as always.
Hi, Warren. Thanks for having me.
I just want our audience to hear about the disappointment over the results in Madrid. Here is Carolina Schmidt of Chile, president of COP25, that is UN speak for the 25th Conference of the Parties on Climate Change.
The world is watching us and they're waiting for concrete solutions, bigger solutions from us, so we're not satisfied. The agreements achieved by the parts are not enough to face the urgency of the climate crisis.
How much of a failure was the Madrid conference?
It was seen as really one of the worst outcomes of any climate conference in the last 25 years. And that's because, you know, several big polluting countries blocked any agreement to have more ambitious climate action. They weren't supposed to say exactly what they would do country by country this year. That wasn't the goal of this year's conference. But the conference was hoped that the conference would at least produce a document that said, okay, next year we will pledge each as individual countries, we will really ramp up our climate targets. They couldn't get an agreement to say even that in the final conference document.
When you say big polluters, obviously the United States is the only country that is pulling out of that agreement, so it's a big polluter that's not involved. What are some of the others?
Well, the United States was involved in these negotiations. It was the last year, at least for some time, that the U.S. was in these talks because the Trump administration, of course, has announced that it will pull out of the Paris Agreement. But that pullout only kicks in next year. And as it happens, the next U.N. climate talks take place just after the U.S. election. So if a new administration comes in the following year in 2021, it can rejoin the Paris Agreement and it can make new pledges. But as for this year's climate talks, there were other big polluters who blocked specific action on specific issues. They included Australia, Brazil, China, and India, each on, you know, slightly different issues. And yes, the United States also made sure to block some things that it doesn't like.
What about some of the nations that are most directly and immediately threatened by climate change, like some of the island nations out in the Pacific?
You heard a great outcry from not only the island nations, but from several others, both rich and poor, that the scientists are telling us that we need to take action very, very soon. The pledges that countries have made under the Paris Agreement don't go anywhere, you know, near as far as they need to in order to avert the most catastrophic impacts of climate change. So there was great hope from many countries and certainly from many civil society groups that government leaders would come together at this session and say, okay, we get the urgency and we will ramp up our climate pledges next year. There was also some hope that there would be some commitment to setting up a specific fund for some of those island countries and other countries that suffer really huge economic losses from extreme weather events and other impacts of climate change. But again, on that, there was no real agreement. There was no specific amount of money committed, but even short of that, there wasn't any specific fund that they could agree to set up to compensate these poor countries.
Seems to me there's a real contradiction here. We just heard Yascha Mounk say that the consequences could be existential. You used the term catastrophic, but Yascha Mounk also said that if we regard it that way and think of it in terms of requiring all of us to change everything we do in every way, that it'll scare people to such an extent that we won't do anything. What's the mood, or what was the mood at the conference in that context?
Look, I think it's very clear that there are some large countries that are responsible for a very large carbon footprint that need to reduce, that if they were to reduce their emissions significantly, that would make a huge difference. So, you know, 80% of greenhouse gas emissions come from, you know, fewer than the 20 largest economies, industrialized countries in the world. What has to change, to your point? Well, you know, kind of fundamental things such as what is the source of energy? Is it going to be continuing to burn coal, which is the dirtiest fossil fuel, or is the world going to transition away from coal to cleaner forms of energy? How do we move from one place to another? Do we continue to, again, burn fossil fuels in order to commute, or do we switch to electricity? Do we get into public transportation and get out of our cars? How do we heat our homes? And how do we grow food? Agricultural production is also quite a significant source of emissions. So those are sort of three big categories that must change. But what I was hearing, at least from scientists and policymakers, is that to make these changes don't necessarily take, you know, unicorn technology at this point. There are cleaner forms of energy for electricity. There are other forms of transportation other than, you know, fossil fuel burning cars. And there are ways to produce food that are not as, you know, that don't produce as much emissions. So, you know, the changes that have to be made in some ways are really profound, but for much of this, the world knows how to make those changes, and it's more a question of political will.
Greta Thunberg showed up, of course, in Madrid, and as a result of her efforts, in part, millions of young people, particularly, have been demonstrating all over the world for this year, and yet this was the worst conference of its kind in 25 years. Does that suggest that they're not having an impact?
Certainly, when Thunberg was herself asked that question, she wondered out loud how much of an impact these protests were having. It certainly is. It's a really stark contrast that's not lost on anyone. Both the accelerating impacts of climate change in the world, the public pressure that you've seen really boiling up to the surface this year, and what leaders of some of these big countries are willing to do at this point. Big disconnect, as I was hearing from many people at this conference.
And does that suggest the political and economic power of the fossil fuel industry?
Certainly, the countries that were most resistant to taking faster, more ambitious action, many of them are governed by leaders who are close to the fossil fuel industry, whether that is China and India, which continues to burn huge amounts of coal, to the United States, to Australia, also a huge coal producer, and Brazil. You really saw Brazil pushing back quite hard on some specific bits of the negotiation about carbon markets, about how emissions trading would work. So it was a small handful of countries that played quite a large role.
Was there a lot of criticism of Brazil for what's happening in the Amazon basin?
There has been, of course, for a very long time. There has been, of course, in recent months, criticism of Brazil's new administration, Bolsonaro's new administration. But in these particular talks, Brazil's position was really most clear on this emissions trading system rules.
What's next? When is the next conference of its kind scheduled? And is there anything significant that is supposed to happen between now and then?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, next year is going to be a really, really crucial year. It's going to be 5 years since the Paris Agreement. And remember, the Paris Agreement was really seen as a high point in international diplomacy. Countries of the world came together and agreed to do their part to avert the worst impacts of climate change. So next year, it remains to be seen whether countries will step up and say, okay, we will really ramp up our climate ambitions. We're really going to bring down our own emissions faster. So that is something to watch if that happens next year. The other thing to watch is, of course, the results of the U.S. elections. And that will play a role in not only shaping U.S. climate policy, but it could also have an impact on other countries, namely China and India, which may be watching, you know, what the U.S. government, the next U.S. government, if there is a next U.S. government, is willing to do in order to say what China and India are willing to do. So I think the U.S. elections next year will have a profound impact.
Let me just reiterate a point that you made earlier, which is that the next climate summit will come very soon after the next presidential election here in this country. That almost guarantees it's going to be a major issue in the campaign.
I think that remains to be seen, how big an issue climate plays in the minds of American voters. Certainly, in public opinion poll after poll, we see that a large majority of Americans accept the science of climate change and want the government to take more ambitious action. We've also seen all of the Democratic candidates say that they will come back into the Paris Agreement. But I do think it remains to be seen, among other issues, what role climate plays in the minds of voters in the next U.S. election.
Okay, great point. Once again, democracy is an uncertain process, and one never knows, and it's very difficult to make predictions and probably foolish to try to do so. Really good to have you on our program as always, Samini Sengupta with the New York Times. Thanks again. Look forward to the next time.
Thanks for your interest.
Today's podcast was produced by the award-winning Andrea Brody. She had assistance from PJ Shahamat and also from Chris Wotherspoon. Thanks to them, our engineer, Chuck Previtari. Now, remember that because you're listening and because you're downloading, you're the ones who make it possible for us to do these programs. So let us know what you want to hear. Reach out. We're at tothepoint_KCRW, or you can tweet me directly at Warren Olney 1. Thanks so much, and have a wonderful holiday season.